Hello, everybody. My name is Dan Kilbride. I'm chair of the History Department at John Carroll University and the host of New Books in American Studies. Every week or so, we find a new book in American Studies. That's culture, history, literature, politics, and we talk to the author about it. This week, we are joined by David Vaught, who's the head of the History Department and professor of history at Texas A&M University. He's the author of The Farmer's Game, Baseball in Rural America, recently published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. This book is in some ways a departure from recent literature on baseball, and there's a lot of literature on baseball, that focuses on the urban and professional nature of the game. This is not a nostalgic take on the game like so much writing on baseball, but the author is also refreshingly not averse to such a take on baseball either. David Vaught is an historian, but he's also a fan. He loves baseball, especially rural baseball. So if you're interested in history, interested in American culture, interested in baseball, this is the perfect summer read for you. Hi, this is Dan Kilbride. I'm the host of New Books in American Studies, and I'm joined by Professor David Vaught, who's the chair of the History Department at Texas A&M University and the author of the book we're discussing today, The Farmer's Game, Baseball in Rural America, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. David Vaught, welcome to New Books in American Studies.
Thank you, Dan.
This is the perfect time to do this interview. This book deals with the local amateur nature of baseball in 19th and 20th century America, and this is the time of the year for rec leagues. Major League Baseball is still early. There's no pennant fever, although I have to say that I've been trying to get tickets for the St. Louis Cardinals in mid-July, and I guess that's what happens when they're 20 games above 500. Those tickets are kind of hard to get, so I'm having a hard time with those. However, you know, somewhere in America right now, as the song by John Fogerty says, there's a brown-eyed, handsome man or a boy or a girl rounding third and heading for home. And it isn't just Albert Pujols. It's some kid or some young man or woman on a dirt field. They're being watched by people in lawn chairs. And that's the heart of this book. It's about amateur local baseball. And it's why it's the perfect summer read for people interested in culture, sport, history, and the intersection of those three things. So, David Vaught, once again, welcome. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, like you said, I'm a professor of history at Texas A&M, and I'm currently serving as department head here, which takes a lot of my time.
I know it. So am I.
Yeah, oh, I remember that. We can commiserate later, perhaps. I didn't really become a historian by my own identity until my late 20s or so did I become a history major. I didn't graduate with a history major until I was in my late 20s, didn't get my PhD until I was in my late 30s. So I was actually sort of new, relatively speaking, to history in terms of my interest. On the other hand, I've been a baseball fan, I think, since my first moments of consciousness. I was listening I grew up in the San Francisco Bay Area, listening to Giants games on the radio. Oh, gosh, since I was at least 5 years old. I used to, unbeknownst to my parents to this day, take the bus to Candlestick Park when I was 10 years old. So baseball, my family really, I think almost like down to everyone, has absolutely no interest in sports. So baseball was really my sort of self-identity long before history was. And it really never occurred to me in any sort of serious way to combine the two until this book.
Now, you've written a number of books about agricultural history, specifically about California. What did lead you to this book in particular?
Well, that's a more difficult question to answer, actually, than it sounds. Some sort of little things. A mentor of mine, when I was an undergraduate, was Jules Tigel at San Francisco State, a very famous baseball historian, and in fact, really one of the very first to make baseball history into a sort of scholarly enterprise. Although I didn't really think of him that way at the time, I thought of him as my history teacher, and he was very much a mentor to me. But I always sort of had that way in the back of my mind. While I was doing the California books, and particularly the second one, I did notice in my research how this is California farmers in Sacramento Valley in the sort of latter half of the 19th century. And I did notice how incredibly popular baseball had become in this area, and particularly by the 1880s, although I didn't really think much about it at first, and I think there might be all but one paragraph or less in the book itself about it. And it only occurred to me much later, and in fact, even into the writing of this book, that really meant that I was onto something, because culture, and I think of culture, I suppose, in a fairly old-fashioned way. Culture is almost by definition invisible to its natives, so sort of taken for granted that it's deemed unworthy of comment. And that's just exactly how I recognized baseball in that book I wrote. Of course, they were playing baseball, I suppose, was my sort of attitude. But when I thought about what I was going to do next, the editor at Johns Hopkins, Bob Berger, asked me, in a very relaxed environment, what do you want to do next? What would you do next if you could do anything you wanted? And I just blurted it out. This idea about I really don't know where it came from, but about it came in part from that research that I had in mind on the California that these people were fanatical about baseball in the 1880s, and that didn't make any sense to me whatsoever as I sort of thought about it. And thought it, therefore, it was worthy of investigation, and that's really just how it started.
You know, this book makes a case for the special resonance of the country and rural America for the history of baseball, especially local baseball over the national game. But you observe you know, lately in the scholarship especially, the focus has been on baseball as an urban game. Why do you think that has been the trend in the scholarship?
Well, I think that's largely because of even the larger or stronger focus is on Major League Baseball and a little bit on sort of lower organized baseball, minor leagues, that sort of thing. That is just overwhelming. I mean, I tempted to say that all of sort of baseball history is about Major League. It equates baseball and Major League Baseball. Mm-hmm. And in fact, even when historians are talking about pre-Major League Baseball, they're talking about it generally as to how it leads to Major League Baseball. So that I'm certainly not discounting that or discrediting that. I find that very valuable. But that's where you get to. That's the urban phase. And in part, if you're interested as many baseball historians are in the sort of origins of baseball, In fact, obsessed with it. I would even argue.
Yes, you do.
That there's, in fact, there's just the other day a story of there's a finding of sorts of I think it was the 18th century in some British newspaper of a reference to a ball game, and people just go crazy when they see these things. But in terms of the development of the game as a profession, then it really does have. Probably has its roots in this New York City game in the 1840s and the 1850s. But baseball has, I think, much sort of deeper resonance in American culture than just as Major League Baseball. We like baseball not just because, as you say, you want to get into the Cardinals game. You like it because it resonates at some much deeper level than that. So that's at least sort of half of my motivation was to examine that more deeply. And I think you have to go to the local level to do that. But the other part of it is sort of, since I am sort of by trade an American rural historian, and rural is a sort of code word in the profession that means not agricultural, in the sense that agricultural is associated with production and economics and government policy and that sort of thing, and rural is associated more with sort of social history, cultural history.
Mm-hmm.
So that's my sort of trade, which is also difficult to understand, trace the origins of, since I have absolutely no background of my own in farming for generations. So I don't have any background in it. But it came back to the, it was really a newspaper that I was reading for the second book, where it's one of these columns that they have it's standard almost in a rural newspaper about each sort of local area gets their own column on one page of the paper, and it's often about gossip and who went where, that sort of thing. But this particular guy was reported every week about the local baseball team, sometimes at great length. So that's what I had in my head. I wrote the essay on California baseball. This rivalry between these two towns in the Sacramento Valley, and discovered that it actually made me understand my farmers much better than I already understood them, and I'd already written an entire book about them.
I'm going to ask a question about something you pretty much just mentioned, and that is you're fairly impatient with the search for origins, the origins of baseball, and the origins of anything else for that matter, as you go on in your book. But in your introduction, you spend a lot of time on a person and a place, Abner Doubleday in Cooperstown, that modern historians of baseball tend to dismiss as just mythological nonsense. Can you discuss what you talk about in that chapter, please?
Are you talking about the introduction or the sort of or Cooperstown chapter?
I guess the Cooperstown.
Okay, well, that's the Cooperstown chapter I couldn't resist doing, even though I didn't really have a lot of specific evidence about baseball in Cooperstown, but because Cooperstown is associated with the invention of baseball and the mythology of it, people have really sort of dismissed or not been interested in the fact that there actually really was baseball being played in Cooperstown and invented there. But in fact, played a fairly, I think, very quite prominent cultural role in the town of Cooperstown in the first half or so of the 19th century. Gosh, it's just that it's just spilling with ironies. This chapter. I mean, one is simply that there are two very major archives in Cooperstown today. One is the library at the Baseball Hall of Fame, which is a very professional and just like any other major archive. And the other is the New York State Historical Association library. They're about 2 miles apart, but conceptually they might as well be 1,000 miles apart. And I would hazard to guess that only a very small handful of people have actually gone to both and spent a considerable amount of time at both, with me being one of them. And that's because when in the debunking of the Abner Doubleday myth, you know, that Abner Doubleday created baseball in Cooperstown in 1839, historians have thrown out the baby with the bathwater. And if I may, I think I'll just tell you about these sort of five pieces of evidence that I have. One is quite well known amongst baseball historians that in 1816, the town of Cooperstown passed an anti-ball ordinance, which has just caused great fun and laughter for people to here's the town that's supposedly known for the invention of baseball actually had this anti-ball ordinance. But no one has actually tried to figure out why was that? What was that? What was that about? This anti-ball ordinance. Even Alan Taylor, whose book on Cooperstown is a spectacular book, and I would say it's one of the best books of the last generation, gets to this point and uses it as to get a laugh, as most people do. But in fact, there it is, this in the newspaper, that the town is outlawing baseball on a very specific street corner in the town of Cooperstown. And it turns out that this is an ordinance. It's one of many, many town ordinances that are passed in about a 5-year period in which is this sort of ongoing battle between the sort of elite folks of Cooperstown, who are sort of personified by William Cooper and his famous son, James Fenimore Cooper, and the sort of common people of the town, the farmers, the artisans, and the like. And it really goes back to this sort of who shall rule at home argument in the American Revolution, with each side having quite a logical argument that they should be ones who rule at home. So there are two things about the ordinance. One, it needs absolutely no explanation for everyone to understand it. So everyone knows what, I think it just says ball. It might say base-ball or something like that. Mm-hmm. But it just says ball. Everyone knows what that means, and everyone knows the significance of that. Ball is something that the townspeople play and that farmers play, and that gives them great joy, and that causes a great ruckus in the town. All of these things that folks like James Fenimore Cooper just cannot stand. There are many sort of layers there, but the main thing is that it's not baseball per se. It's not the game that you and I would recognize. Historians often refer to it as town ball, but that's also misleading in that, because it implies that there's a game with a set of rules that everyone plays. But actually, I mean, if you go from town to town, even in central New York, everyone's playing by a different set of rules. I mean, it's a local world, so it stands to reason that it's a local game.
Right, right.
So that's one piece. The next is something that I just sort of stumbled across while I was flying through newspaper microfilm at the New York State Historical Association there. And that's I can't think of his name, but his last name is Doubleday, and he's reminiscing in about 1891. He's an older gentleman. He's reminiscing about very fondly about the days he used to spend on his uncle Seth Doubleday's farm back in the 1820s. And one of the things that he mentions is that they played ball on Seth Doubleday's farm. Seth Doubleday is also the famous Abner Doubleday's, I believe, great uncle. So there's lots of irony there. But it's just another item that indicates how deeply rooted the game already was before it was supposedly invented there. There's also in one of James Fenimore Cooper's probably most obscure novel, and obscure because it's very pessimistic as opposed to most of his others, which are quite optimistic from his perspective, called Home as Found, in which there's about a 3-4 page passage between characters about a lot of, I think 5 or 6 of his novels are based right in Cooperstown and are based directly on figures in the town, including his father, in probably the most famous book. But here, they're in his big mansion, which sits right in the middle of Cooperstown and is a great symbol of elitism amongst the common people. These boys have trespassed onto his lawn and are playing ball. And again, it's a case where no one has to explain to the contemporary reader what ball is. Everyone knows what it is, and again, everyone knows what the significance of it is. Then there are these two in baseball circles, very famous letters from Abner Graves to Abner Spaulding, Albert Spaulding, who in the early, I can explain this quickly. In the early 20th century, there's a debate that goes on in baseball circles as to whether baseball was invented in America or whether it's really an offshoot of British games like cricket and rounders. And of course, the Spaulding, who sells baseball equipment and sports equipment. And as a former pitcher himself, and has a lot of interest in Major League Baseball, wants the game to be American, thoroughly American. So they celebrate a commission, and they put ads in newspapers across the country, asking sort of old timers if they know anything about the invention of baseball. And lo and behold, this guy Abner Graves ends up writing 2 long letters to Spaulding, saying that he thinks the game was invented. He never actually says invented, but that the game originates in Cooperstown, and that's it. That's really the entire basis of the Abner Doubleday, invented by Abner Doubleday when he was cadet at West Point. About 20 years old. So again, though, no one has really read those, other than to sort of ridicule them. Mm-hmm. No one has particularly read them, or I'd say reread them. And analyze them, because they're actually, he's very, very specific about his memories. He mentioned 7 or 8 of his friends who were there, all of whom, a quick look through Ancestry.com will tell you that they're all there. They're all real people, and he mentions very specific places that were all there. He's not making this up. I mean, his memories, and again, he never actually says he witnessed the invention. That's sort of Spalding and this commission, and they took that to mean that. But there's actually a lot of, if you read these as historical documents, there's actually a lot of information there. That's so I've really sort of, I don't know, re-debunked these Graves letters that tell you actually a lot of what's going on, and most of it cannot be discredited. Let me put it that way. A lot of the information, and I think that I can't know this for sure, but I think that the best reading of these letters would be to indicate that this sort of scene that he sets where his friends are playing sort of town ball, and here comes Abner Doubleday to tell them about this sort of different game, and in his mind, better game. I think that that's not altogether unlikely. That's a way of skirting the issue.
Well, the story that you tell about the Spalding Commission is a lot of fun in the book about how Spalding definitely had a goal in mind. And there's interesting things in there about, you know, anti-British sentiment that he was, you know, at the time he was very dedicated to making sure that the rounders and cricket were discredited as sources of baseball.
Right.
One of the things you discuss in your book is the popularity of baseball in rural California, you know, in the decades following the Gold Rush. How can you explain the avid enthusiasm for baseball among farmers?
Well, in California, farmers are risk takers, just by nature. Particularly once this sort of farming becomes sort of market oriented enterprise. It happens at different times in different places, but say early 19th century in California, that sort of risk taking nature is compounded by the fact that this first generation of Anglo-California farmers doesn't come to California to farm. They come to California to find gold. And if they came late, which is to say after the initial year, 1849, as most people who came late, they fail in the gold fields. Mm-hmm. And that failure brings on a certain, for many of them, a certain shame, personal shame, so that they can't go back to most of these people are coming from the Midwest. They can't go back. So they become California's first generation of farmers. Baseball is played. I mean, actually, there's evidence that baseball is played on the migrant trail, on the pioneer trails, on the way out to California. Some small evidence, but the game doesn't become just this insanely popular until the 1880s, And the 1880s is a time when there's great change going on in rural California. There's generational change. This first generation of farmers is transitioning to their sons, and agriculture itself in California is transitioning in a way really unlike any other place or time in America, from a largely wheat-growing state to a largely specialty crops or fruit-growing state. Over the course of, say, roughly 20 years, California goes from being the nation's leading wheat producer around 1880 to, by 1910, they're actually importing their wheat, and to becoming this much more intensive and fruit-growing operation. That brings, as you might imagine, sort of great anxiety to this new generation, and sort of, and at the same time in the 1880s, the game of baseball has evolved to what you and I would recognize it as today. Virtually every rule, every nuance of the game is in place by the 1880s, and it's a very, particularly compared to the sort of town ball game, it's a very structured game. The rules are very clear. The game is played. Everything's very sort of automatic. You do things automatically. And it's my argument that baseball played, in this sense, a very sort of critical role in how these particular farmers were understanding their world, if you will. They're changing, they're rapidly changing world. They value the game greatly for the structure that it imposed upon them, structure from the rules, the way that the game rewarded their hard work, rewarded their attention to detail, all the things they wish that farming, or believe that farming should do, but in fact doesn't do in the modern economic world. So there's a sort of parallel between the two, and it's I think I used the word antidote for their sort of troubles, and I think that's what's at the root, if you will, of their. I just can't tell you enough about how fanatical they were. I mean, there are these two towns, and they had this massive rivalry between themselves, and not just the players, but fans, for this whole decade, at least, of the 1880s. And in a sense, it's never stopped.
There's a sort of a parallel chapter to the one on California that deals with Texas. And I can imagine a reader opening up this book and having a preconception about what they're going to get in that chapter, but I think they're not going to get it, because right away in that chapter, you're talking about teams that are rooted in immigrant communities, teams that are based on Czech immigrants and German communities. And these are not, what you might call Anglo-Americans. Many of these teams are very rooted in ethnic communities. And you see Texas, in the 1890s and early 20th century as a place that is sort of teetering on this razor's edge between modernity and a much more traditional society. How does baseball inform that tension that you see in this place and time, Texas, in the early 20th century?
Well, I think as you pointed out, this was the most surprising chapter to me. And it came about from a photograph that's in the book of these German farmers playing the game in a very sort of very informal manner, probably about the 1890s. And I saw that I was fooling around at an archive about 50 miles from here, a local archive, and there's this picture. And it didn't make any sense to me. They knew who the people were, and they knew they were German, probably second generation German farmers. And boy, in Texas, it takes three or four generations for Germans to be assimilated, for lack of a better word, where they're still not, you know, they're still speaking German. Their schools, churches are all in German. So, you know, what is this? Why are they playing? So that's the, in the particular county that the photograph taken in, Fayette County, the census will tell you in 1880 that for four major groups, ethnic groups, the largest in terms of numbers, the largest group by far is are Germans, and the smallest group by far are Anglo. And I can't remember, and then between our Czechs and African Americans, and I can't remember which one was which. So it turns out that you know, we just assume that baseball is going to resonate first with Anglos, and then if it spreads at all to other ethnic groups, that's how it will spread. But in fact, that baseball became most popular first with German immigrants who began playing the game. I don't know where the game originated in Texas and who brought it where, but I know by the 1880s, and Germans who love to have festivals like Mayfest and Oktoberfest, mm-hmm. and they're great celebrators of 4th of July. Of course, much greater celebrators than they sort of teetotaling Anglos were, and they at these festivals began playing baseball. I mean, it's just there it is, in the documents, and gradually the game spread from something played at these sort of special activities. To what's really sort of a feature. These are all cotton growers, all basically 25-acre cotton growers. How cotton is grown at that point. And cotton has a cycle to it that's at times extremely intensive, and at other times not so intensive. So the cultivating process is very intensive, and then for lack of machinery and technology and alike, when the plants are planted in the rows, they have to be meticulously weeded, just up and down the rows, day mm-hmm. after day after day, until the plants sort of grow large enough so that you literally can't get up and down the rows, and the plants are sort of shading the ground enough so there are not going to be any weeds. At that point, maybe early July, late June, there's going to be about a six-week period where, with regard to the cotton plants themselves, there's not a whole lot to be done before they actually harvest. And this is called traditionally in the South laid-by time, because it gives people an opportunity. And they don't just sit around and do nothing. We have lots of things to do on mm-hmm. farms.
Sure.
But it's time is not of the essence. And baseball starts to take up some of that time. And the more it's played, the more it becomes rivalries again between these little small towns. And at the same time that Germans are doing this, Czechs, who are even much more meticulous than the Germans are, and much less likely to do something fun, also get hooked on the game. I mean, very, very careful with whatever money they have, but this is a case where the father is still, buying their sons baseball gloves at some, incredible large percentage of their income. and Czechs and Germans, immigrants have this sort of strange relationship. On the one hand, they need each other. On the other hand, they don't particularly like each other. But in baseball, that plays out in baseball, where a predominantly German town will play a predominantly Czech town. At the same time, there are large numbers of African Americans in this part of Central Texas, left over from slavery, and they too learn baseball from the Germans, but there's never any interaction between they play amongst themselves. So baseball has this way of in some ways mediating between these different ethnic groups, and other times it has a way of sort of pointing out differences in these groups. But in that chapter, the main find, if you will, was that Germans were the ones who popularized the game.
There are two chapters in this book that are devoted to individuals. My favorite was the one on Gaylord Perry, and we'll get to that one. But you also talk about a figure that is very widely known among baseball fans, and that's Bob Feller. Why do you think Americans found Bob Feller, quite apart from his 100-mile-an-hour plus fastball, to be such a compelling figure? And specifically, one of the things that is so interesting about that chapter is the role of his father in popularizing and manipulating Bob's story to conform to what Americans wanted to hear about Bob Feller. So what can you say about why Bob Feller was such a compelling figure and how his father made him into such a compelling figure?
Well, I mean, aside from the the fact that he sort of burst onto the scene 4 months before his 18th birthday and struck out 15 St. Louis Browns in the very first game, and went on to this sort of stellar career. I mean, Feller was fourth generation Iowan on the same farm. And boy, it's hard to put this in a nutshell. But when he burst onto the scene, the story immediately was about poor farm boy makes big star in Cleveland. I mean, first of all, he wasn't poor. His father was a quite successful a farmer, and a very shrewd and savvy farmer who was able to sort of manipulate his way through all the sort of economic difficulties of the 1920s and the 1930s, and was a very strong figure in the County Farm Bureau. He was not a hayseed, as it were, as he was actually often portrayed. So that story from poor farm boy to big star sort of allows Americans to sort of celebrate their rags to riches ideals. Again, with his father often being portrayed as Paul Feller in the newspapers amidst the very background of rural simplicity. But Feller, his father was no stranger to this sort of big city condescension, if you will. Again, he was not a hick or a hayseed. He was a modern, sophisticated farmer. And he knew they lived about 10 miles from Des Moines, capital city, largest city in the state, probably. And he knew, I think, really sort of instinctively how to capitalize on this American's attachment to this agrarian ideal, this very simplistic agrarian ideal. And really right away, when Feller was still sort of 17, he put this, he and reporter for the Des Moines newspaper ran this a series of articles about young Bob growing up on the farm, and it was billed as autobiography. I mean, it was called like Bob Feller, My Story, kind of thing. And this ended up being picked up by dozens and dozens of major newspapers across the country. It's hard to imagine how sensational this was. And when Feller graduated the following year, he had a full, in the middle of the baseball season, NBC Radio broadcast his graduation, like 18 people, to his local high school in its entirety. And there were like 10,000 people at this place trying to just catch a glimpse of Bob Feller. And his father created the myth of Bob Feller. A lot of the stories about Bob, about his pitching in the local teams when he's 12 years old, and rolling the ball across the floor when he's two, all that kind of stuff.
And breaking two of his father's ribs, right, was one of the stories.
Oh yes, and playing, pitching at playing catch in the barn. Barn is still there. The barn is now a agricultural monument. It's a fantastic barn. But that's where they played catch in the barn at night in the dead of winter. Just on and on and on. There are all these myths. And a lot of them are true, but greatly exaggerated. And Feller himself is telling these stories 50 years later, and he's quite possibly the greatest self promoter, and that goes a long way of saying that in baseball. And the stories that were told in this first newspaper series worked for him for the rest of his life, and it worked for him in his obituaries from a couple of years ago, still talking about the same thing. So that this chapter is much more about this sort of rural urban dance that goes on. When you talk about rural urban conflict, we're usually talking about the smart, sophisticated urban people outsmarting.
Well, like the reporter for the New York Times, who you discuss early in that chapter, who just epitomizes urban condescension.
That's right.
Toward the countryside.
That's right. But in fact, he's not Will Feller's father. I mean, it's not. Farmers knew what they're doing. This is how farmers are able to get through legislation that every urban person, like AAA legislation and getting paid to not farm, that every urban person instinctively thinks is insane. But they're able to do this in part by, I mean, if you look at any, including to this day, any sort of farm bill, it's going to be loaded with all this kind of of fake agrarian stuff because it works. People, it's in part why baseball itself is popular. Baseball. There's an abstractness to baseball, a rural abstractness that accounts in large a lot for its popularity. The game captures the essence of the American rural experience. I mean, you don't even have to if you just say Abner Doubleday or this whole field of dreams.
Yeah.
I mean, and every opening day, you hear these broadcasters sort of wax poetically about the green grass and the blue sky and all that, and nobody thinks twice about it. This is one of the first things I thought about when I started this project, and epitomize this, that where else other than a major league ballpark, when you're sitting in the middle of a row of say 30 seats or so, you pass down a $20 bill. It goes through all kinds of different hands, strangers' hands, down to the hot dog man, and you do that with the complete and total expectation that you're not just going to get back the hot dog, you're going to get back every penny of change. And I would hazard to guess that it's never happened otherwise. You know, you never get it. And that sort of, it sounds a little hokey, but that sort of innate trust and sense of cooperation roots in our agrarian heritage. It epitomizes, again, this sounds kind of hokey, but I think it epitomizes what Thomas Jefferson thought a nation of farmers would become.
Mm-hmm. One other side to that is, sort of rural canniness and sophistication, and that sense is really represented in your chapter on Gaylord Perry. I just want to tell my favorite story from this book. And of course, Gaylord Perry is famous for spitball. And everybody tried to nail him on this, umpires, opposing players and coaches and journalists. And my favorite story from your book is the one about the reporter who's interviewing Gaylord Perry's 5-year-old daughter. And he figures, I'm going to nail this kid. This kid is, she's a little girl and she's naive. And so he asks her, does your father throw a spitball? And she says, oh, no, it's just a hard slider. And I just thought, here's a 5-year-old girl who knows what's coming, and she's been prepped for this, and she knows exactly what to say. And so, in your chapter on Gaylord Perry, you argue that, the spitball that he perfected tells us a lot about, his roots in Southern culture in the mid part of the 20th century. And that his story, from a sharecropper's son to a baseball phenomenon to a failure as a farmer, has a lot to tell us about popular culture and race and just changes sweeping through the South in the mid 20th century. Just tell us about what you think Gaylord Perry's story has to tell us.
Well, first of all, he's simply a fascinating historical character. He's part of the sort of last generation of sharecroppers in the South. Mm-hmm. He's part of the last generation segregation in the South, or at least organized or legal segregation. And he's also transforms pitching into from something that's largely about statistics and ERA and win-loss and all that to, you know, nobody cared about that when he was pitching. I mean, they wanted to watch him work his mm-hmm. his magic. And he's, you know, sort of book-wise, he's not the smartest guy, but in terms of what he became with being able to sort of manipulate other teams, other managers, other fans, and go on to become one of the greatest pitchers of his generation, just really something. I mean, here's a guy who grows up in a, it's not even a town. It's sort of typical in the South, and particularly the tobacco South, where in the 1940s and 50s, there's still absolutely no mechanization to tobacco. So it's grown almost completely on 25-acre farms because that's the size that a family of four or so can grow crop of cotton and sort of make a living. So he didn't have electricity or plumbing, all these things, even though 10 miles away in the town of Williamston in eastern North Carolina, which is maybe 6,000 people, they've had these things for a couple of generations. I mean, it's really sort of strange to read through Williamston newspapers, and it's like a regular 1950s, the ads and everything, just regular 1950s stuff, whereas, you know, 10 miles away, it's this community they call Farm Life, quite appropriately, where people are living in a really sort of primitive fashion. But he goes to high school, and he's one of the first people to go to the Consolidated High School in Williamston, where he takes his first shower, that sort of thing. And mm-hmm. his father was just like Bob Feller's father, and they were playing baseball. As soon as they could pick up the ball, he and his brothers, also a very famous pitcher, Jim Perry, and he's just spectacular. He's about 6'2" and 200 pounds as a junior in high school, and extremely great athlete. Throws as a junior, throws 5 no-hitters until the very last game, state championship game. He doesn't let a single hitter get to third base. It's just spectacular. So he comes from this community, and surrounding communities that are like it have a sort of tradition of country baseball, as it were. Every pitcher is throwing, not just throwing a spitball. I mean, they're throwing a tobacco ball, where they just heave on the ball. Every pitch, and you can imagine what that does to the ball.
Yes, I can.
And so he comes from this culture of both with baseball and especially with tobacco farming, that you do whatever it takes. I mean, it's just you do whatever it takes to succeed. And he was one of the first pitch players to benefit from a change of the rules about how much players could be signed for. There was a previous rule through the mid-1950s that you couldn't sign a player for more than $4,000 unless you were going to immediately put them on the major league roster. And so nobody did that. And that rule was changed so that when he signed in 58, I believe, with the Giants, he signed for $75,000. So it was really quite something, but it put, as you might imagine, a tremendous amount of pressure on him, and he stumbled in the minor leagues around for about 4 years. Even when he came up, he started in 58, and he doesn't really come up for good until 1964.
Mm-hmm.
And just keep in mind, this is someone who's going to win over 300 games and strike out 3,500 people, and he's already 25 years old, and he hasn't even started yet, basically. But that's where when he learns the spitball, which even then is not an immediate success. It's really not till 66 that he, you not only have to control the spitball, you have to learn how to hide it.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Not just from the other team, but from 50,000 fans. And then once he gets the hang of that, they change the rules that you can't throw a spitball, meaning you can't go to your mouth on the mound. It's still the rule. So you have to change to so-called foreign substances that to this day he has never revealed. He still plays this game where he absolutely will, you know, come on, Gaylor, tell me where you hit it. He will not tell you.
That was fabulous. I love that.
So I'm glad actually you like that, because in the sort of scope of the book and the sort of amount of space I had, I couldn't do full justice to the story. So I'm in the process now of making that into a full blown book.
Oh, fantastic. I'm glad to hear that. In your epilogue, you touch on a number of things, but one of the things you talk about is the popularity nowadays of so-called vintage baseball. You know, baseball, it's almost the analog of Civil War reenactors, about people who are obsessed with contemporary uniforms. They probably have mustaches and beards that harken back to the 1870s. They're very interested in the texture and materials of the baseballs and bats. Why do you think vintage baseball is enjoying such a resurgence today?
Have you seen Game?
I have not.
Oh, okay. It definitely goes. I mean, they're all over the place now, and they're really worth. It's really worth going to. It's really much more powerful, I think, than sort of Civil War. Reenactment, because it's not staged. I mean, it's a real game.
Right, it's a real game, yeah.
And fast-paced, unscripted contests. And they play, I mean, if you want to get sort of snippy about it, they're not altogether historically accurate, but they play by a certain set of rules that they say is, I believe, it's the 1860. And it's kind of an amalgam between town ball and baseball. I mean, you know, you're out if they catch the ball on one bounce. They're out if you can throw the ball at the runner, and if you hit them, they're out. Some vintage teams don't go that far, but it's a whole different sort of set of rules and of. A lot of them play it because they're disgusted with the current state of Major League Baseball, the money and the steroids and all that kind of stuff. But they at least the game the couple of games that I went to, I mean, they purposely play in sort of rural settings. As rural as they can get, where they could usually go to the local field and baseball field or softball field, but instead they just play it on this big long piece of grass that is on this lake, and this gosh, the ball gets by the guy in right field, it's going to go into water and the game will be over. It's downhill slope, but they do that. because they're trying to get as sort of accurate as possible, and they prefer to play the game in a sort of imperfect way. And it just serves as a reminder, I mean, it's the way it's sort of in the book, that baseball has, you know, long served as a distinguishing characteristic of rural America. I mean, urban America too, but also rural America, and really strong, sort of two parallel, not always overlapping ways. And what it really emphasizes is, again, to get back to what we started with, is that baseball is really much, if you're trying to understand baseball in the context of American culture, it's really much more than just Major League Baseball.
Mm-hmm.
It's if you watch one of these games and watch the sort of joy that these people have. I mean, they all have nicknames, and people come up to me and show me all their broken fingers. You know, they don't play with gloves, and it's just like a badge of honor that they have these broken fingers. So I know a couple of people who do it, and I used to think they were crazy, but now I have a better understanding. They're still crazy, but I have a better understanding of them.
Well, David, we have taken up more than an hour of your time, so I want to thank you for speaking with us today. And the last question I have, I don't know if you want to answer this as an historian or as a fan. You know, baseball is it's got a lot of competition nowadays, and I don't know if an honest person could describe it as America's sport anymore. The NFL is just enormously popular and getting more popular, and you might look into the crystal ball and say that, you know, in the future, soccer is going to enjoy. I know it's been, people are predicting this for a long time, but maybe it actually will happen looking at youth soccer nowadays. What do you think the future of baseball is in the United States? Does it look good or does it not look good?
Well, the commissioner will tell you it's good. I mean, it makes lots of money. But I think baseball has become almost a sort of antiquarian game, particularly in the context of football. I mean, if you watch, I mean, I don't know what this means really, but if you watch SportsCenter, and if you can equate like how SportsCenter prioritizes their stories every game, if you can equate that with popularity of in America. Baseball is way down. I mean, if even in May and June, where there's absolutely no football news, football is going to lead off in SportsCenter. Baseball rarely is. If there's anything else to highlight, they'll highlight that before they highlight the baseball. And in this context of this, you know, highlight generated sports culture that we're now in, baseball didn't do very well in that, because if you only look at baseball highlights, which I do all the time. I mean, every morning I wake up and I get email from the San Francisco Giants that encapsulates the game from the night before, and you see the highlights, but baseball is not about highlights. I mean, you're gonna miss 80% of the game if you're only looking at highlights, and I don't think that's necessarily true with football or basketball.
Right. I mean, yeah, you could see a great catch in a baseball game, but it might not really impact the game. Where if you see a 75-yard touchdown in football, it probably did impact the game in a major way. So yeah, I think you're right.
I don't think
that
it's going to disappear or anything. I mean, it's still an enormous money making. But I don't know. I know 20 years ago, I would spend a lot of time with certain friends talking endlessly about the intricacies of some game or baseball. And it's increasingly hard to find people to do that with.
Well, David, thanks so much for talking with us today, and I look forward to the next book on Gaylord Perry. Can't wait for that one.
Well, thanks, man. I very much enjoyed it.
You bet. All right, take care.
Okay.
We've been speaking with David Bott, author of The Farmer's Game, Baseball in Rural America, published by the Johns Hopkins University Press. My name is Dan Kilbride, and this is New Books in American Studies. Take care. See you later.